Hello?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, okay. Good morning. Okay, we're holding today in the 34th Perek, the Perek Lamed Dalet of the Gvuras Hashem. We're going to be talking about today. I was not so accurate last week. We're not going to focus tremendously on it. It's going to be more on Bechoro specifically, but we're going to speak more about the Makos, about the plagues which God brought upon the Egyptians. We've been talking about elements and patterns in those plagues, the different things which popped up in the process. And as we said, and as the Maral regularly references, this is only one of a couple of places where he speaks about this in this work. Here he's discussing it during this section of the work, Gevuras Hashem, which is following the order of the story as it appears in the Torah. And then later in the work he goes to talk about the Haggadah. And the plagues, of course, appear in the Haggadah as well. So he's going to discuss them again there. And there's some doubling, and there's a lot of complementary. There's a lot of, you know, he says something here, he says something else there, that, you know, adds to the picture. So that's where we're up to, and what we're going to speak about in this chapter, about a number of the details already. However, what he's going to speak about today, we're going to have a little a piece at the beginning, a discussion of the plague of Choshech, of darkness, a small discussion about Bechoros, about the plague of the firstborn, and then he's going to speak a little bit about the set. The entire setting of the series of ten. Why the series of ten and the different elements, the way the series of ten Makos actually breaks up. And there are a number of very significant, nice, and of course worthwhile points here in this discussion. The first is about the plague of Choshech, the plague of darkness. And the Maral brings a Medrash, quotes a Medrash, that the Medrash says, Mehechan haya ha-choshech. Where did this darkness come from? The darkness that we speak about here in the plague of darkness was not just power failure, you know, where we have plagues of darkness every time it snows a little bit over here in Baltimore. It's not simply lights out. The darkness in Mitzrayim was, of course, a darkness of the Maoros, the luminaries that normally function, the sun and the moon and the stars that naturally provide light, didn't provide light. There's the expression in the verse of Vayomesh Choshech, the darkness was essentially like a tangible darkness. It was like, you know, people see say, and you know, like a pea soup, you know, like they couldn't move. The verse says, like, Kom Ish Mitachtov. Right, a person didn't move. They didn't move for at least 3 of the 6 days of the plague. The darkness was so intense that they couldn't move. They felt they couldn't move. It was a paralyzing darkness. And as such, we understand that it's something more than just, okay, you know, normally the lights are on, now the lights are off. There was something else which was going on here. And in the Medrash, it brings two versions of what that something else was. Where did this darkness come from? Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemiah. Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemiah debate this. Rabbi Yehuda and Nechemiah are very frequent counterparts in Medrash debating these kinds of things. Rabbi Yehuda says, Mechayshech Shalmala. It came from the darkness above. As it says, Yoshes Chayshech Sisrei Tzvivaysav Sukasai. The verse says, it's a verse in Tehillim, that Hashem's hidden place is within the darkness. There is a dark black hole, I don't know what you want to call it, some kind of a dark space that surrounds and quote-unquote protects Hashem, God's place. That's what Rav Yudach said. Rav Nechemiah said, no, it's the Choshech of Gehenim, it's the darkness of Gehenim, of hell. That also is associated with the darkness, as it says, Eretz Ayifasek Me'ayfel Talmaves V'loy Sidarim. And you know the expression, which we know better from the 24th Psalm, from Mizmor LeDavid, is we speak about Gate Talmaves, the valley of the shadow of death, which implies the darkness right? Choshech va'avadon, right? The darkness of what it calls here the darkness of Gehenim, the darkness of hell. So the question is, what is this debate? What's this debate about these two kinds of choshech, these two kinds of darkness, which exist here? And the Maral says, we have to understand that when we speak about darkness and light, we speak about them not only in a physical form, but also in a conceptual form that matches the physical. When the lights are out, nothing is going on. When the lights are on, that's when there is activity. Darkness represents heder, the absence of blank, absence, emptiness. There's not something going on here, right? You pass by, you know, you come to, right? I needed to grab a minion, right? So I looked up in the Erev book, and there was a minion in a certain place at 7 o'clock for mincha, right? I had to be somewhere, and I went there, and I drive up, and the place is dark, so I knew that they have to update the listing. The truth is, I looked at a list which was a year old, but obviously that shul changed the schedule. They didn't daven at 7 o'clock. Okay, so on to the next place where they knew they daven at 7:15. Right? You know, but you know, that's it. Darkness, when the place is dark, it's empty. There's nothing there. There's nothing which is going on there. When the place is light, when it is lit up, so then you know that stuff is going on. You know, there's a famous medrash about Avram Avinu. That when Avram Avinu, how did Avram Avinu discover HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So it says that it's compared to a person who passed by and saw a bira dilekes. A bira is like a palace that was dilekes. Dilekes means what? So from the term dolek is could be on fire or to be illuminated. And in fact, there are two ways that people, and so the person says, what, how could it be? Right? You see something like this and there's nobody in charge? Right? There must be that there's somebody in charge. And then the Balbir says, yes, I'm here, I'm in charge. So there are those who interpret it that they saw the place on fire. Right? Avram Avinu saw the world and everything was crazy. He says, I don't understand, how could this be? The world is so beautifully and intricately constructed, and yet now, nobody's home? What's going on? How could this be? Right? That's the way some read it. Others read it is that if you pass by a bir, you pass by a palace, and it's all lit up, and it's all illuminated, there's got to be somebody home, right? So it was more of a positive view of the things. The creation is described as follows. In the beginning, Hashem created the earth, the heaven and the earth. And the earth was tayu vavayu, was empty, nothing, emptiness and nothingness, empty and void, however you are used to translating it. V'choshech al p'nei Yisrael, and there was darkness on the surface of the waters, of the deep waters. And the Spirit of God was there hovering on the surface of the waters. Right? It's like this big picture of a mass, of an undefined mass of nothing there in the world. And in fact, there was heaven and earth, but there weren't yet plants, and there weren't yet animals, and there weren't yet birds, and there weren't yet anything. The first thing that Hashem created was light. Vayomer Elokim hiyah, let there be light. And if we're going to start creating something here, the first thing we have to do is got to turn the lights on. Right? Choshech is absence, or is presence. Or is presence. So says the Maharal beautifully that if you look at existence, in a certain sense, existence is framed by heder. It's framed by absence. There was a heder, there was nothing before Hashem created the world. When you think about what we just described, that at the beginning of the time of creation, the world itself was embedded in Chayshach and darkness. If you want to look beyond that, before Hashem even created the heaven and the earth, so of course there was absolute darkness outside of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, outside of Hashem himself. And says the Maral, that's the image which we have of the darkness that surrounds HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that surrounds Hashem. if you're going to say, here's God, and here was the creation, till it came before, between God and the creation, there was the absence that came before creation. The absence of existence to anything other than God that was there before the creation. So if you want to, right, Chazal have an expression, for example, that a person cannot look at malifonim, what was there before? What was there before the world existed as we know it? It's murky, it's dark, it's not something that we're able to see.
Rabbi, is that where God hides his face?
That's the language of the verse. The language of the verse is that his protected area is surrounded by darkness. Sisrei. Right? Elsewhere it speaks about bamistorim, the hiddenness. You speak about where God hides his face, so you know, there is such a thing that there are times when Hashem reveals himself to the world and times when Hashem does not. And that's what's called, that's correct. Right. But here we're speaking about it on its most basic level, not even within the function of the world, where we speak about sometimes Hashem shines his presence on the world more vividly and sometimes less, but before existence even came, pre-creation. That's the darkness that we speak about here. And then there's a darkness of post-creation, because what Hashem created in the world is finite. Hashem himself, right, with us, and our physical beings, we are all limited. Hashem is the one who is what we call the Ein Sof, the infinite. But a human being is finite man. Everything in creation, in a certain sense, has its limits. Right? People, we consider nowadays that the universe is, you know, expanding and in a certain way of its own infinite. But relative to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there's always finitude. And certainly man and the human beings on earth, the human condition, is such that it has an end. That's part of our built-in human limit, human frailty. And so there's the darkness of Gehenna, which represents when it's over. When it's over, that which disappears. Of course, we have a little bit way out of the darkness, right? Because we believe that the soul of the person which is coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu can make it that a person can gain eternity to be in the presence of Hashem. And that the grave, therefore, is not a limit, is not a boundary where the person can't, the person doesn't go beyond. So that's the darkness, so to speak, at the end of the tunnel, if you see it, but there's a vision of light that could be there too. You know, there's a beautiful medrash. Medrash is found even more so in the Zohar, where it describes when Avraham wanted to buy a burial place for his wife Sarah. So what did he do? So he came, she died, and he said, I want to buy that cave, that double cave that's in the field there in Hebron. I want that to be the burial place for my wife, for Sarah. So the question is, why did Avraham Avinu have an interest in that particular spot? Now we know that tradition tells us, Machpelah, those who are studying the Daf Yomi, in fact this was just quoted in the Gemara last week, if I'm not mistaken, that Machpelah refers to the fact that there were four pairs that were buried there, four couples, including Adam and Chava. Adam and Eve were buried there. So Avraham Avinu must have known that. But how did Avraham Avinu know that? So the Medrash says a fascinating thing, that when Avraham Avinu was inviting his guests, right, when he ran after those three to invite them into his house, so they agreed, and then it says he ran to the cattle to get them to prepare. So why does it say they had to run to the cattle? So the Medrash says the following story, that Avraham Avinu was running after, went to get a calf, and the calf, you know, apparently knew the end was near, so it ran away, and it ran, and it seemed like you were just chasing after that pesky little calf, right, that didn't want to go like sheep to the slaughter. So he runs after it, and finally the calf runs into a cave, and Avram says, ah, I got it now, and Avram follows the calf into the cave. And you expect, you know, it's like going to be a dark, musty cave. And he comes in there, and suddenly he is overwhelmed by a beautiful, beautiful fragrance, like an apple orchard, like Chakal Tapuchin Kadishin, like an apple orchard like Gan Eden. And he comes in, and then he sees the light, and he finds there these two people, a man and a woman, perfect, beautiful, lying there with light over their heads, candles by their heads. And he says, oh my goodness, Adam and Chava. And he, so the calf showed him the way, right? The kindness of Avraham Avinu showed him the way, and he went out, and he said, when it comes our time, mine and Sarah's, I want to be buried here. So, 37 years later, it came Sarah's time. So Avraham Avinu knew exactly what he wanted. He said, I want her to be buried there in that cave. So he said it. Now Ephron says, well, what's going on? Why is this guy asking for this cave? I have this cave on my property, but like, what's going on? So Ephron says, hold on 1 second, let me think about it. And he goes to the cave, and he looks around, doesn't see anything. It's just dark, musty. You have the cave? Let him have the cave. So he gave him the cave. So the Medrash says, you see that you can only see what's yours. Right? Sometimes, if you have no connection to it, you won't be able to see it. You won't be able to perceive it. So, what's the idea? What was the name of this guy, by the way? His name was Ephron. You know, in Hebrew, there are many words which have a vav nun, which are appended to them. Nachshon, Shimshon. Right, the core word is the word, right? Own is ski, Owitz, Berg, right? His name was Ophir. Ephron is, the name Ephron is Dusty, right? Right, like the guy from Texas in the pickup truck, right? Ephron is Dusty. Ki Ophir Ata, because you are dust, and you will return to the dust. Avram, that's the definition in the Torah of death and burial. And isn't it an amazing thing that the person who he buys a burial plot from, his name is Dusty, right? Imagine if you went to Levinson's and he said, "Here, here's this new guy. He's our new funeral director here. His name is Dusty." It's a name which is suitable to a picture of death, which is the dusty, dark grave. Which is exactly what Ephron perceived, which was exactly what it would be for Ephron, because his life was defined by his physical existence. Well, when physical existence ends, the curtain comes down and it's dark. But Avraham Avinu, his life was not defined by self-serving physical things, but it was defined, as happened in that story, which that story, parenthetically, is where Avraham is contrasted with Ephron. Ephron promised Avram the world. He says, take it for free. What is it? 400 silver pieces, big deal. And then Avram paid him 400 silver pieces, crisp, perfect currency, and he took every penny. Right? He promised the world and he did nothing. Avram Avinu, we say, is the opposite. He promises little and he does a ton. He said, I'll get you a little water and bread, right? And then you'll go. And then what does he do? He runs after the calf to give the meat. Why? Because one of them shows a self-absorbed, self-serving nature, which is physical, which ends in the grave, and one of them shows a generosity, a will, an interest to give, non-self-serving. That was Avram's key to the world of the spirit, was his chesed, was his giving. And so Avram Avinu didn't see death as darkness as the end, but he saw it as light. There's such a thing as a person having this world as a stepping stone to the real thing, to bigger and better and brighter, a brighter future. But that wasn't true of Parah. So for him, says the second opinion, Reb Nechemya, or whichever one it is, the Medrash doesn't say who says what, he says that the darkness of the Choshech was the darkness of Paro's end. Right? So there's a darkness which is there before the world comes into existence, before Hashem creates something with all of its potential. There's an absence of that. And then, when that potential reaches its own end due to its frailty, then there's a darkness as well. One of them says, this is what the darkness of Egypt is, and the other one says, that's what the darkness of Mitzrayim is. So the Maharal says, what's the argument? The argument is that according to the first opinion, the darkness was a darkness which came from Hashem. It was the Makkah, it was a plague which came from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore, the source of the darkness is, you know, going back to Hashem. And I would supplement it a little bit by saying that, you know, there's a tradition that we have that's really highlighted by the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos and the Chazal accordingly in Pirkei Avos, that says Hashem created the world with 10 statements, and then later Hashem demonstrated his creation of the world with the 10 plagues. Right? The 10 statements nobody was around to witness, except Adam was there for the last two. Right? But nobody else was around to witness them. We didn't see creation. We didn't witness creation. Mitzrayim, when Hashem took us out of Egypt, so then he demonstrated his hand in creation as a whole. And he did it with 10 plagues to correspond to the 10 statements. The plague of darkness seemingly corresponds to the world before light. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is doing. He's saying to Paro, he says, you know, I want you to know, but for me, you wouldn't be here. But for me, you have no existence. So the plague of darkness reminds them that there was life before there was Paro. There was life before there was Mitzrayim. There was life before the Nahor and Nahora of Mitzrayim. And then on the flip side, there was life before, and Paro is being reminded of that, but he's also reminded that he has limits. He's going to meet his end. This is the end for Mitzrayim, and therefore there's the darkness of Gehenna. So there are two ways to view it. Again, whether you view the way the Maharal phrases it is, do you view the plague in terms of its origins of God, and speaking about the darkness that surrounds him, that relative to Hashem, nothing really had to exist, and Hashem brought it into existence? Or is the darkness about the recipient, the butt of the plague? And that's Paro, and it's reminding him of his darkness, of his end, of his weakness. That's the way the Maharal explains this medrash. I think it's a very beautiful beautiful medrash as amplified by the Maharal. The darkness before and the darkness that followed. Okay, that's element number one of this perek, of this chapter. Element number two in element number two, the Maharal deals with an issue of language, which I'm just going to very briefly touch upon, just for the Shleimus HaInyan, just to convey it, and then we'll move on to his discussion of the scheme of the Makos of the plagues. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nehiyah Bidvarei. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he spoke to Paro, he said, Kachatzos Halayla, Hashem said that around midnight, that's the way we translate it, Kachatzos, near midnight, I'm going to go out into Egypt. And then what happened? When did the plague of the firstborn actually happen? It happened by he, Vachatzos Halayla, it was at precisely at midnight. So Rashi says, famously, right, it's in the Gemara, why did Moshe Rabbeinu say around midnight when Hashem was planning to bring the plague at midnight? So he says because Mitzrayim wasn't Switzerland, and they didn't have good watches in Mitzrayim. And what would happen would be that Moshe Rabbeinu said it would happen at the stroke of midnight, and the official clock, right, the Itzagnine Paro, the people who were aware of the movement of the sky and the stars and so on and so forth, their calculations may be off by a drop, and they'll say, it was 12:01 or 11:59. So their clocks may not be calibrated with God's clock. So therefore, he said, around midnight, so they wouldn't make a mistake. So Maral says, I have a question. But then when it came exactly at midnight, then again, they would say that he made a mistake, because he said it would be around midnight, and it was actually at midnight. Now, I would have thought that that's not a question. I would have thought that around midnight includes midnight. But I do hear it, that it could be a question. Right? Kachatzos Halayla means in the vicinity of such and such a time. And then to come at exactly that time when he said in the vicinity? I mean, if he was planning to come exactly at that time, say so. So Maral says something else. He says something, you know, which is very interesting linguistically. The way we normally read this Rashi, it's the way I think, is the way we normally say it, which is that I could say at midnight, or I can say around midnight. Bachatzos is at midnight, kachatzos is more or less around midnight. Says the Maral, no. It's, in a certain sense, it's the difference between describing a time and between describing a process. Chatzos, Bachatzos is describing midnight, that time. Kachatzos is more like chatzos as a verb, right? As the night divides. And that's not describing a specific time on a clock, but it's describing more like a process which happens in nature. And that process which happens in nature takes a certain amount of time, so to speak. Right? There's the moment in the middle, but it's the process, and the process includes midnight, includes beyond. So Moshe Rabbeinu, instead of choosing to address the moment on the clock, instead frames it in terms of the process, which is equally true, and it's going to be as that process is happening that this has Moshe Rabbeinu. Doesn't say a time, he just says the activity. That's the way the Maral says it. I'm not going to dwell on it, you can too much, but that's just the short version of how he explains that. Okay, so now let's go on to again one other small detail when it comes to Makos Bechoreis, and then we'll go on to the Seder HaMakos. The small detail when it comes to next one on the left. The small detail when it comes to Makos Bechoreis is that there are two versions, which it says in the Torah. Once it says Hashem, all the firstborn in Mitzrayim will die from the firstborn of Paro until the firstborn maidservant. And then another place it says who actually died, it said, and they all the firstborn in Mitzrayim died from the Bechor of Paro to the Bechor of their prisoners. So the question is, which one is it? Like, what's going on? What's the inconsistency? So, you know, Rashi really speaks about each one. Maral explains it, you know, some sense, and he says like this. When he's warning him, he says, till the Bechor of the maidservant. Why? Because that's the lowliest of which the Egyptians would care. Right? If a prisoner in jail, Bechor Ashi Asher Beveis Havor, the prisoner in jail is not useful. He's not making license plates, right? It's Bebeis Havar. He's there sitting in the pit called the jail. He's a useless, it's the government has to feed him, right? So it's no major threat to say, you know, the firstborn prisoners that you have there in jail, they're also going to die. That wouldn't move Paro. But if you say the firstborn of your maidservants, of your household help will die, that does move him. Right? We're going to lose not only our own family, but we'll also lose our help. So in the warning, he said that. However, when the plague actually came, it came to anybody who had a trace of Bukhar in them in Egypt. Anybody who had any culpability, Rashi says that why should the prisoners suffer with the Egyptians? Because they also, you know, they were happy, they rejoiced at the suffering of the Jewish people, even though they weren't actually doing it. So therefore, there was something for which they deserved it, but otherwise they wouldn't have had it at all. But the Maral says that's the difference. In the warning, you want to tell them something about which they will care. In the execution, it describes how far it went, and it was so pervasive, the plague, that it even hit those that the Egyptians didn't care about, but they still deserved to get hit by the plague on some level of the firstborn. Okay, so that's the second little detail. Now let's look here at something which is less of detail and more of a broad picture. Beautiful broad picture. Hashem brought 10 plagues on the Egyptians. Not only did he bring 10 plagues on the Egyptians in Egypt, but then he had the splitting of the sea, and then we had other events which followed. The verse says that the purpose of the plagues was not just what we find in Bereshis, where it was promised, where it was that I'm going to punish them, it wasn't just for the purposes of punishment. In fact, what seems to be accented much more in the actual story of the Exodus was that it would demonstrate that I am God. It would demonstrate the power of Hashem. That was the purpose of the plagues, the many plagues. So, therefore, obviously, the system of providing 10 plagues is to demonstrate, through these various steps and stages, the fuller and fullest extent of God's power in the world, that He is God. So how does that happen? How do these 10 plagues demonstrate that? How do they gradually graduate and show more and more God's power within the world? That's the question. So there are many approaches to this, some of which we're going to see here. In other words, why 10 plagues? What are the 10 plagues? What's happening in the stage of the 10 plagues? So listen to a system which the Maral lays out here first. He says the Bria creation has many strata, has many levels. And Hashem has to demonstrate His power on every level. So let's start all the way at the bottom. The bottom is the sea. Right? Sea level, as you know, is where we consider where the earth starts, is the top of the sea. Right? So the sea has creatures inside. So the first thing Hashem hit was all the way down on the totem pole of the earth, was the sea, by bringing it blood, by turning the water into blood. The sea is home to other creatures, right, which are a step above, right? The sea is the home, the arena, and the creatures that are within it are the next step. What inhabits the sea? Well, the frogs, for example, inhabit the sea. So the next level of creation that Hashem showed His power over was by the inhabitants of the sea, by the frogs. Once you get past the sea, what's the next level?
Right, they also live in the sea and inhabit it.
Transition. Okay, good, very nice. The frogs jump out, so good, that's good. They're even could be seen as transitional. The next level is the earth. And the third plague was where the earth turned into life. So it's like the water turned into blood in the first plague. And the third plague, the earth, the dust became buggy, became kinim, became lice. Then what's the fourth plague after the kinim is right, is orov, is the animals, right, the wild animals are the things that inhabit the earth, just like the frogs inhabit the sea. The animals inhabit the earth, and Hashem, just like He let the frogs loose on Mitzrayim, now He let the animals loose on Mitzrayim. Okay, what comes after that? Right, so the next one is Dever. What's Dever? Dever is a plague. How's a plague born? B-O-R-N-E. Right, how is a plague carried? Plague is carried through the air. Right, if the water is below earth level, and the earth is above sea level, what's above the earth level? The next thing is, right here, our airspace. And that's what happens, right? Something is an airborne plague, the Dever, that is the next level of creation. So you understand the scheme. Okay, we're halfway through. We're going to pause for station identification. But the idea that the Maral is trying to teach here is that what we find and what we say, what we just said when we finish Shachris, know that Hashem is the God, is the power, b'shamayim mimal v'al'oretz mitachas, all the way to the heavens above, and all the way to the earth, all the way down below. And ein oid, and there is no other. There is no other. So we want to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem's power extending all the way. Now it's interesting, Maral does not explain this. We will try to look at it hopefully a little in a few minutes. But he's starting from the earth. One would imagine you might maybe want to start from above and make your way down from God, you know, down here. But he actually starts from the bottom up. Okay, so we're up to, we covered now five plagues. We have the sea and what inhabits it, the earth and what inhabits it, and then the atmosphere. That's Dever. What's Shchin? Shchin is a plague of boils which hit people. Like, where does that fit in? So the Maral says here something which is very creative. At first glance you say, boy, it sounds like he's stretching it. But the truth is that it's very, very good. Very, very good. Shchin are boils. What else does the term Shchin, the root of Shchin, what else does it mean? What? No. No. I'm missing the kuf is Sharashi over there. Right? Shochan, like Shchuna. Shana Shchuna is hot. Shchin is hot. And Rashi explains in Parshas Tazria, right, where it discusses the mitzaras, and one of the plagues of leprosy is bashchin. It speaks of shchin or michva, if it appears on a boil or on a burn. And Rashi says they are both heat generated. Boils, got it? Boils, right? Okay, right? Where does the term come from? It's not, I always thought, right, when you don't think about the Rashi, that the term boil is because when what happens is you boil water, bubbles, right? Bubbles come up on the surface. So a boil is a bubble, right? But Rashi says, he's not explaining the English, he's explaining the Hebrew, that shchin has, the term shchin means heat. And the idea is because of some internal, like sort of like feverish, you know, heat that generates a boil that appears on the skin. So he says basically a michva is a burn from the outside, right? When you face, his skin hits the iron or a match or whatever it is. And a shchin is when body heat, and so for some reason, is hit here, maybe a wound where he says, you hit the person over there and that creates a certain heat in the body and it causes a boil to develop. But it's a heat-related thing. What were you going to say?
Inflammation.
Inflammation, very good. Excellent. So the Maral says, this is Aish, fire. There's a way of looking at the four elements of the world. This is found in Chazal and found Lahavdil as well in Greek philosophy and medieval Greek writings, which is that there are four basic elements. What are they? Dust, water, air, and fire. Okay, now, lest this sound medieval, you just think about it yourself. What did you learn about the different states of existence in science, of matter? You learned about solids, afar, dust, liquids, water, gases, avir. Okay, we only learned three. What about four? How do you convert something from a solid to a liquid, from a liquid to a gas? Energy. Fire. So look what we have. We have the mayim, the sea, we have the afar, we have the earth, we have the avir, we have the air, and what comes next is the fire. Shchin represents a plague affected by fire. Instead of looking where it goes, which is on the skin of the animals and on the skin of the people, look at what it is. That's the Maral's chiddush, which he says here, moving up now to the aside, to the element of fire. It's interesting that usually when we speak about them, we speak about Ofar being on the bot. Ofar being... Michael, you still there? Michael, you still there? He's probably on mute. Dr. Elman, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, fine. I just want to make sure that you're not clicking. Okay, I'm going to ignore it. Okay, So usually we view it as earth, water, air, fire. And that's actually based on Bereshis, Pasuk Beis, chapter 1, verse 2, where it says, the earth was tohu vavohu, empty and nothing, darkness, which is the absence of light of fire, on the surface of the water. Right? So the surface of the water is, there's the water, and earth below the water. When the entire earth was covered with water, so then the earth was below, the water was above it, then there was the ruach, and then there was the chayshach. Right? Those are the four levels. The way the Maral has it, he doesn't address this explicitly, but the way the Maral has it, in the world as it is now, where there's earth that's exposed, the earth is above the water. The earth is above the water. What bracha did you say this morning? Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Reika Haaretz Al Hamayim. Blessed are you Hashem who spreads the earth over the water, right? That's a bracha which originally we would say when a person swiveled off of the bed and put their feet on the ground, they would say, blessed is Hashem that gave me terra firma, that gave me earth that I could step on. You go deep down, there might be water underneath. So water, earth, air, fire. Okay, shchin. Next. Borad. Right? The next plague is hail. Where's hail? Hail is also in the air. But it's not in the air down here that you, excuse the pun, inhale, right? But it's from the higher sky, right? The hail is already there in the clouds. And that's that part of the atmosphere from where that comes. In other words, the dever is down here, you know, this air down here that we breathe. The hail obviously comes from the clouds, from a higher part of the atmosphere. But we have not only that higher part of the atmosphere, but we also have next, what comes after that, the inhabitants of the higher part of the atmosphere. And what's that? The arba. The arba are the locusts. The locusts are flying creatures. So just like we had the water and the frogs, and we had the earth and the animals, we have the heavens and the locusts. Now, us Marylanders will struggle with that. And the reason is because our locusts emerge from eggs that are buried in the ground. Right? But they end up flying around. They come, right? They come from the eggs in the ground, but they end up flying around.
I put them much more after the dever than after Borod, though. I mean, they seem to be much more inhabitants of the lower air rather than the cloud air.
No. He has them flying around. He specifically addresses it, and he explains as follows. He says it is in the category of the birds. That's the way he views it. Again, was the arba exactly as you read about the arba? You know, in the days of Yael, it flew in, it came in. I think it darkened the heavens and the earth. That's the way the Torah describes it.
A Jew this year, by the way. Not the real one.
I think just it's just like this is the false stuff.
It's
you know, be a good year to go to Egypt for a vacation. and then what happens? So Arba. Now, what's higher than the sky? What's higher than the sky from which things rain? Right, from where birds fly. Is the upper sky from where the sun and the moon and the stars reside, where the plague of Chayshach, which takes away the higher heavens where the planets reside. So it keeps going up. Isn't this amazing? Isn't this like it's fantastic. It's fantastic. You say, okay, one second, you tweak this. There are little tweaks that we wouldn't have thought of instinctively. But when you look at it in the framework of the whole structure, I don't know, to me it's pretty, pretty striking, pretty impressive. And then what's the last one? Is Makas Bechiris, the plague of the firstborn. Now hold on one second. Right, they live down here. Why weren't they, you know, stuck in the middle someplace? Says the Maral, no. Because that was people. Makas b'chayres is maka b'nishmas ha'adam. The plague of the firstborn didn't hit physical people. It hit people who have a body and a soul. And it was a plague, the Maral explains, it was a plague which struck, of course, which killed them by striking not at their bodies, but striking at their souls. And the soul is higher than the sun and the moon and the stars. The soul comes from all the way, min ha'al yahinim, all the way from beneath Hashem's heavenly throne, as Chazal say it in their illustrative speech. But we understand what it means. It means from way beyond. So we've gone up, 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 up. And we've seen how Hashem's control extends from the earth below all the way to the heavens above. Fantastic. Question. So once you did that, why does Paro need demonstration phase two at the Yam Suf? Why does he need to split the sea? Why are the Egyptians running after him? Says the Maral, gorgeous. He says, let's look at the verse. Remember, what's the difference? This is something which we say in the Haggadah, in that part where we do all the different opinions, 50, 200. I remember, you know, when we get to that part in the Haggadah where we say, how many plagues were there in Egypt? 10. How many plagues were there at the sea? 50. Why? Because in Egypt it says that they saw, they said, that's the finger of God. But in Egypt, but at the Yam Suf, they saw the hand of God, the verse says. There are five fingers and a hand. So if there were 10 plagues in Egypt with the finger, so then at the Yam Suf, where it was a full hand, there were 50. That's what we say in Haggadah. And then the other one says, no, there were 40 in Egypt and 200, and there were 50 in Egypt and 250, whatever it is, however far it goes. But the idea is that the contrast between Mitzrayim is and the Yam Suf was a finger versus a hand. What does that mean? Says the Maral, a finger is a prat, is something, a detail, something specific, something narrow. The hand is the whole, is the whole unit, full hand, right? The full hand. Says the Maral, when the Egyptians were skeptical, they saw that Hashem had ability to influence something here, to influence something there, but it was like with a finger, right? You can touch, right? If you ever try, right? If you have a bag over your hand, you try making a phone call, right? You can't, right? The finger, right? The digit, what we call, you know, it's able to point, you know, to be able to get, to even hit these ridiculous sized keys on your BlackBerry, right? You're able to, you know, to hit, you know, one thing at a time, right? If you try to do it with a hand, what are you going to do? You won't be able to do it, right? Because the finger represents a detail. So this is the next stage of demonstration of the power of Hashem. We see that Hashem can shoot, right? He's a good sniper. He can do a little thing here, doesn't do another thing there. Where do you see that Hashem's power is all-encompassing, that he can't just hit with the detail, but that he can do it much more broadly? There you need to see the hand. And the hand is demonstrated at the Yam, at the sea. Why? Says the Maral, because that's the same difference between the sea and everything else. As we say in Koheles and Ecclesiastes, it says, Kol anachalim holchim el hayam. All rivers lead to the sea. Right? That's a biblical quote which became an expression as well that people use. All rivers lead to the sea. The sea, the ocean, is collective. It's where everything, where all the waters of the world end up. Right? The Nile River, the Ya'ar, got plagued by the thing, but that's a spot. It's a spot on the globe. When you come to a sea, to a yam, then you're seeing what's called a Kayach Klali, a general power. Now, of course, the Red Sea was not the Atlantic or the ocean. It wasn't even the Mediterranean Sea. Right? But still, it has that quality of a yam, of a collection point of the various separate things. So he says yam does represent something more broad, and therefore that's where the yad, that's where the broader hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was to be demonstrated. Okay, great. So you understand, we've gone from showing, demonstrating all these different levels. We say, but still it could be targeted. So we say more general. Is it over? It's not over. Because, one second, we just saw Hashem's general hand in the sea. Do we see Hashem's general hand higher up? So says the Maral, what happened after Kriyas Yamsuf, after the splitting of the sea? Was it over? Was Hashem's demonstration over? Well, it was over for the Egyptians. They ended up in the sea. But then what happened was that Amalek came to fight us. And what happened when Amalek came to fight us? So Hashem, it says that they fought them ad bay Hashemesh, until the sun set. And so he says, you know, Chazal say that when Amalek came to fight with the Jewish people, the sun stood still for Moshe Rabbeinu, like it stood still later in the Navi for Yehoshua. So that was a power over the sun, and the sun is a kach klali. It's a general power that's in the world above. One could ask, why isn't that covered by the plague of darkness? I'm not sure what the answer is. But the plague of darkness seemed to be just more, you know, the sun did its thing, but Egypt did not benefit from the darkness. It was still, the sun was still functioning. Here, it was like the sun as a whole, as a koach over the entire world, was sort of suspended, the way Chazal see it. And then, the sun is still only something. Remember we said when we were doing it, Chayshech is one thing, but then you have to have something even higher than the sun. What's higher than the sun? The soul. That which is divine. So what you have for that is Matan Torah. Where HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as the Maral says, as Chazal say, Kara HaShamayim, Mishmei HaShamayim, Hel Yayinu Beher Lehem. Hashem split open the heavens, the upper heavens, everything, that we're able to have a view directly, straight to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, all the way directly to Hashem above. So says the Maral, this is the demonstration, level after level, detail, and then level after level in the more broad sense. That's how he shows it. Now I just want to, so this is the middle of the chapter, we haven't finished Perek Chavdala. The Maral will present a couple of other theories, some more familiar, some less familiar. But I just want to conclude with one thing, which is that we asked, it would seem that it wouldn't make sense to go in the other direction. Right? To show Hashem above, and then, you know, closer to him, and then how his reach extends below, 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 till it reaches all the way down here. Why does Hashem start at the earth below? And I believe that it may be that the approach is as follows. The nature of the land of Mitzrayim, of Egypt, as described in the Torah, is that it is earth disconnected from the heavens. Remember, it says that Egypt and Israel are not the same. In Israel, in Eretz Yisrael, you're dependent on the rains that come from the heavens. The land of Israel cannot exist earth alone. It requires the heavens, because the water sources are, the water source is rain. That's why when we say in Shema, "L'man yirbu yameicha v'yamei v'neichem," you should have long life on the land that I promise you, like the days of the heavens over the earth. Kimei Hashemayim al Ha'aretz. What does that mean? And because in Eretz Yisrael, everything is Hashemayim al Ha'aretz, the heavens over the earth. But in Egypt, they weren't dependent on rainfall. In Egypt, their water source was the Nile. And they viewed themselves, therefore, as being completely earth, completely and totally removed from the heavens. Perhaps in that framework it makes sense that the first place to strike is to show that Hashem's there in the earth, in Mitzrayim. And then to show, slowly but surely, how the earth is connected to the heavens, and how HaKadosh Baruch Hu's power extends, and it's down here, and here, and here, and here, and all of that is having a devastating impact on the Egyptians. And they imagined themselves as living in a balloon, in a bubble, which was separated, right? But Hashem shows them, first of all, in that bubble of yours, I'm there. I'm down there. And that bubble is not really a bubble, because you see, step, 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 you know, go, rise up, and you see how it all ends up ultimately attributing itself to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Perhaps That's why it starts that way. That's the structure of the Maral. One of the structures the Maral assigns to the Makos. And I imagine we all learned something new today. Okay, very good. Have a wonderful day and a good tovach.
Rabbi, being lishma.
Michael, thank you for your interest. Got it.
Being literal. Frogs, yeah.